Hey everyone, it's Lainey. I'm releasing this Get Vocal livestream that I did where I had author Elaine Smith on to talk about her book, A Gun in My Gucci. Now, I'm releasing it as a regular episode so that you have an opportunity to submit your entry by Thursday, where I will be drawing the name of the winner on my Get Vocal livestream on Thursday. Don't worry, we'll be back to a regularly scheduled episode next week. Okay, on with the show. All right, everybody, thank you for joining us for True Crime Thursday on the Get Vocal platform. I'm your host, Lainey. I host the True Crime Fan Club podcast and the paranormal podcast called It's Haunted, What Now? And I am joined by a very special guest for this evening's live stream. That would be Elaine Smith. So, Elaine, welcome to the show. And please share a little bit about yourself with us to introduce yourself.
Well, thank you for your comments. I was an English major in college, but I actually really hated writing. So this book was an endeavor that was like blood, sweat, and tears, because writing, I think, is really difficult. But it was a story that I thought was just so phenomenal that I just needed more people to hear it, that Kenneto and myself were able to come together under some really drastic circumstances and give the initiation of numerous cases prosecuted that really did take down the management of the Chicago mob.
It was amazing. Pretty intense, the way that everything kind of unfolds. It's like every time I got to a new chapter, I was like, oh my gosh, this is gonna fall apart, and then I'm like, okay, never mind, it's not, somehow it's saved. So there is an interesting story that you share briefly in the beginning of the book about how you first kind of got introduced to the world of true crime, if you will. And it's a very personal experience that happened when you were younger, which is pretty much my biggest fear and something my mom hammered into my head that was going to happen to me when I was younger if I tried to go outside without permission. But you were kind of in a time where you could leave the house and there was no problem. Like, the idea that you were walking to the movies with your friend was mind-boggling to me, because there's no way I'd ever be able to do that, you know, during the time I grew up. So would you mind sharing that story with us so that we can kind of get an understanding of where you started?
I think I call it the day Chicago lost its innocence. There were two young boys kidnapped off a streetcar, and then later found, cut into pieces in a forest preserve around Chicago. And then there was another kidnapping of a young lady who was found in a drum in the lake. And all of a sudden, kids that were walking around, like going over to your girlfriend's house or going to a movie on a holiday, became really scary, became very almost life-threatening, because all of a sudden these kids started to be taken off the streets. And that's, I had a guy that followed me. I knew this man was following me. I tried not to believe that it was, really a bad person when he stopped the car and got out of the car and attempted to drag me into the car. And I pulled away and ran into like a candy store that was open at the time, and called my father to come pick me up because I was afraid to walk home the rest of the way. I was terrified. It was a defining moment of my life. And I never forgot it. And ever since that point, I started looking at license plates. I taught myself the models and makes of cars. And when I really did become an FBI agent, the people that I worked with, the guys, were like shocked when I could call out the city and the make and the kind of car that things were and license plates, because it had been emblazoned in my fear and my experience to make sure I got those details down.
Yeah, it was a trauma response to something.
Yes.
And it's incredible that that's kind of what happened out of that trauma was something that really helped you in your career and being able to recall those facts quite quickly.
Yes, I'm sorry it did. I'm sorry yeah. I had to experience this because as a young girl, it was
terrifying,
it
I'm sure.
Really changed my life. It did change my life.
And I found it quite interesting. It kind of took me aback a little bit by your anticipation of your father's response to you calling him out of fear, that you were kind of like, oh, he's going to be upset that I called and that I'm scared to go home, I guess. And was that kind of a norm or something? I don't know, because I know that, you know, I don't know how the response was then, or if it was like, ah, get yourself home, kid, you know, you live in the city.
It was sort of like that.
Yeah.
It was, we were not babied. It was a time when you don't cry,
mm-hmm.
You hold it in. Even for girls.
I was going to ask, even for women.
Yes, even for girls. And so, but it did teach me a lesson. My father was very loving, but he was also, there was really a divide between adults and children and what children could expect.
Mm-hmm.
And children could not expect their parents to drive and come and get you or leave the house and come and get you, much less take off work. No one took off work. No one went to your assemblies. It was like they were working. They had to work because they had to get food on the table. And there was no fooling around.
Yeah.
You took care of yourself.
Yeah. You were pretty self-sufficient, it seems. And that's kind of been how you've been throughout this book. I was just like, I call you when I was promoting this episode, the resident badass of the FBI, because I am so truly enamored with the way you took charge of your life and of your career. And it was an interesting jump that you took from being a school teacher to going into the FBI. And once we get to your training in the FBI, I'm going to call out a moment in the book that made me laugh and go, yep, I'd probably say the same thing. But can you tell us a little bit about that jump from going to teaching school to now trying to, you know, spar one-on-one with guys in your FBI academy?
Well, I'll tell you how I made the leap, because I became a school teacher in the ghetto of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most violent, threatening place that these children lived in, and therefore the teachers that came into the neighborhood lived in. I had like 43 fourth graders, and I was in a mobile unit.
Oh, wow.
Which during the riots was burned. I mean, all my bulletin boards, all my books, everything was burned down.
Oh my.
Because they rioted and burned the neighborhood. And I would hear shots fired. I found a dead baby in the garbage can.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing that the FBI could do to me would ever match the trauma that I had for the years that I taught in the ghetto in Chicago.
Wow.
It was, if any kids made it out of there, they were miracles, because they lived in such violence every day. And you being a teacher, you went into that violence every day.
Yeah.
And sometimes it spilled over on top of you. So I think that's what gave me anything that the FBI asked me to do. Oh, well, this is nothing. I was a school teacher in the ghetto.
Yeah.
I knew what the race riots were. I knew what it was like when Martin Luther King was killed. What you throw at me is not going to frighten me as much as I was then. At least you give me a gun.
Yeah.
Right. At least I had a gun when I was a school teacher.
And I get to use it.
I had a pointer. I mean, you know, big deal.
Yeah. Were you ever threatened in any way while you were a teacher? Did you ever become fearful because of an interaction where you were like, wow, I don't think I want to do this anymore? Or
yes, I did. Well, the children were incredibly violent. Were incredibly, mm-hmm. if another child touched a pencil on their desk, their first reaction was to explode, because mm-hmm. that's what they saw at home.
Mm-hmm.
Their first reaction was they were going to hit somebody upside the head. They were going to fight. I mean, they were walking an edge of keeping their lives together which was totally surrounded by violence, and not being able to trust the adults that they were supposed to be taking care of them.
Yeah. I can't even imagine how tough that must be, especially probably even today, knowing how the crime rate has escalated in Chicago and probably maybe significantly worse than when you were a teacher then.
Yes. I mean, I think all these people are being shot on the streets, and there are children witnessing someone being shot, maybe in the head, wherever, but falling on the sidewalk. And I can't imagine how traumatic that must be for them.
Oh, yeah. The trauma's got to be so intense and crazy. So you finally take the plunge and you decide to go to Quantico to become an FBI agent. And I love the way that you portrayed the background investigation into you as an agent, because as a layman, I will say, when I think about the FBI and, you know, the interrogations into the backgrounds, I imagine they're like, well, what did she do here? And what did she do there? And you basically said the questions were very boring, you know, when they were interviewing your friends and were like, hey, could she shoot somebody? And they were like, yes, Elaine totally
could. Yeah, in a New York second, this chick could shoot somebody.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I don't know. I mean, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And
that's what we had to do.
Yeah.
To save someone's life or our own lives, man, you were going down.
Yeah, you were like, hey, it is what it is. Yes. So I thought that was really interesting. And that kind of dispelled the magic behind that. So I was like, oh, okay. Because in another world, I dreamed of joining the FBI or CIA. And then somebody was like, oh, well, you have tattoos. You're easily identifiable. You'll never go into the field. And I was like, okay, never mind.
Well, that doesn't count. Everybody
yeah, not anymore.
Tattoos now.
Oh, I was like, not anymore. Yes. I missed my big break there, Elaine. So you go there and you start training. There aren't a lot of females in your class of FBI agents. So what was that like? I know it didn't seem to me in the book when I was reading it that you were super intimidated by the fact that there weren't likely going to be a lot of females. It was more of like, well, I'm going to be the one. I'm going to be the one that's here and I'm going to make it, or they're just going to have to kick me out. But what was your mindset? Did you ever think about that truly in a sense of like, I got the deck stacked against me in this, and I really got to show off.
Well, the guys in my class were in the same position that I was. Mm-hmm. They were trying to prove themselves. They had to pass all these tests the same as I did. And they never really intimidated me unless it was really in the boxing ring, which I, of course, was totally horrible at. And wrestling, they could always overpower me. Mm-hmm. Academically, no, they couldn't. I could hold my own. I just finished my master's degree. I was kind of accustomed to studying, and mm-hmm. I slipped right into that. That was pretty easy. There were 30 men and 6 women in my class. And I never expected to have those 6 women be my friend,
mm-hmm.
because it just wasn't set up like that. It was like each one was fighting for themselves. But it didn't turn out that way. As we got to know each other, we became very bonded. Mm-hmm. We were very careful and protective of each other. But actually, we didn't really relate to the men. Mm-hmm. We really, it was each guy, every guy for themselves.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that's created that way? Because we think about law enforcement agencies as having a camaraderie, right? Where it is, you protect and, you know, you're protecting your brothers and sisters out there. But when you're training, it is like, hey, you're on your own. You can't expect anybody to be there behind you if you have to do this. So why do you think that is, or what do you think it gave you in the sense of whenever you finally transitioned on into the field, you know, having that camaraderie, and it took a while.
A lack of camaraderie.
Yeah, lack of it.
You know, when I went to Quantico, Sly and the family had this We Are Family, that song.
Yeah.
All my brothers and sisters and me. And I thought that that's how it was going to be. And then I got there, it wasn't. It was like, man, these women were trying to stab you in the back. It was like every dog for their own.
Yeah.
We did all become friends much more than with men. Because men, I don't think really... They were under such pressure and struggle And they didn't identify with how that was compounded when you were a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So the women in my class, we became very close. My roommate, I'm still very close to today. She lives in Atlanta. We see each other often. But the men, it was like boot camp.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like every guy has to prove themselves. And I can't help you because I'm barely making this myself.
Yes. So. I want to talk about quickly that experience you had in the boxing ring with, I think, Orlin or something is his name.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I don't want to give his name. It's embarrassing. He'll be embarrassed.
Yes. I thought it was so funny because it was I could see you there, right, kind of taking these hits and you know, just swallowing your pride and being like, hey, you know what? I'm not going to win this fight, but I'm going to try my darndest to like get through it. And you finally finish and your instructor comes over and says, hey, come to my office. And then can you share with us kind of what the conversation was from there?
All right. So if any of you, if you have never been punched in the face, it's an experience that is not pleasant and it's very shocking. And particularly if you're a woman, because no one punches you. I mean, I didn't wrestle when I was young. I had an older sister, but she never punched me.
Yeah.
I mean, we just weren't accustomed
to that. We did punch
people. Yeah. So this guy had to punch me. A few of the guys were, you know, I were boxing and they were kind of doing it lightly with me. And the gym teacher said, come on over and really come over and fight her. And then I really got it. I mean, they just 1-2 punch on me, you know? And we wore helmets. And after this class, he said, and I took my helmet off and there were tears in my eyes. God, you never cried. You never absolutely ever cried.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I was punched so much that I
couldn't help it.
And he says, Smith, come to my office. And he brings me into the office and he shows a picture of my husband boxing. And it was taken as an advertisement or showing what agents did to train.
Mm-hmm.
I never even knew he took the picture. And he says to me, now I am going to make you as tough as your husband. And I said to him, well, the only thing I could think of when I was beaten up was that I was going to have my husband come and beat the shit out of that guy. And he said, no, Smith, no, you're going to beat the shit out of that guy. Yes. And so, okay, I have to wrap this around my head. Yeah.
I guess.
I got to be a big girl. I got to put my big girl pants on and my gun.
Yeah.
And I'm going to break.
And then I'm going to kick his ass.
Yeah. Then I'm going to kick his ass.
I thought that was so hilarious because I was like, that's what I would do. Except I call my brother and be like, hey, this guy just beat me up in class. I'm ready to beat you.
Big guy that you can have that will come to your defense.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. But what we haven't touched on yet is that your husband is also a former FBI special agent as well. So was it always kind of in the back of your mind that you were going to be a part of the FBI? Or was he just, I know he had mentioned to you that you would be a good agent or a great agent is what you turned out to be. But how did that kind of come to fruition to where he was telling you this? Was it just something he saw in you and was like, yes, and kind of subconsciously?
Yeah, I think it was something that he saw in me. I think he saw that he likes people that are tough.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw that I really was tough when I lived through teaching in the ghetto.
Yeah.
And then every time we were transferred, the FBI transferred him around, I got another teaching job. I was always the one that had to scramble to get a job after he was transferred with the FBI. And he thought that I would make a great agent. And many agents asked him, why did you ever do that? Why didn't you want your wife to be an agent? And he said, well, I always thought she'd be a great agent. And he witnessed other women coming into the bureau. And he thought that I could hold my own, that I could really give some recognition that there are women out there that can really do just a good job as a man.
Oh, yeah. And you proved that.
And that was why.
For sure.
And I'm telling you, you really don't get in fights.
Yeah.
Agents don't get in fights. I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah.
So you really, you know, all you have to do is schmooze people, talk to people, not be afraid to approach
people. Right.
That's the whole job. That was the whole job. It wasn't fighting.
Yeah.
You didn't get into fights. Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. So you are a baby agent and you're ready to hit the ground running whenever you finally pass the academy. And I thought, I was like, God, what the ambition behind this? I love that because I'm like, we've all been there where we've, you know, gone into our career and we're like, all right, give me the hard stuff. So 9 to 5, I work in HR. And I was like, give me all the crazy cases because I do employee relations. So I was like, give me all the crazy cases.
Yeah, you've seen it then.
Yeah, I want all the sexual harassment, all these things. And everybody's like, wait a minute. You need to learn this, this, and this. And you need to learn how to talk to people to get them to be forthcoming with you before you can just walk into a room and be like, hey, did you do this? And I saw that in you when you first passed the academy. You were like, all right, what am I doing? So they kind of gave you a really, like, you know, grunt work to do when you first started. And I didn't really grasp what this Title III business was. So it was like, oh,
Title III is like one of the most important methods of investigation that agents can do against organized crime. And that's when you wiretap their phones or put a wire in their office or in their living room or in their kitchen. And on that, they speak very freely and they talk about their crimes. They can talk to somebody else that's a criminal and they'll say, don't talk on the phone. 5 minutes later, they'll start talking about doing a robbery or something. And I mean, it's just astonishing.
Yeah.
They rarely use pay phones. They use their own phones or the phones, the pay phones that were at the places they hung out. So that was where we got a lot of information and prosecutable, that they would start talking about the things that they did, the hijackings that they did, the robberies that they did, the muscle that they put on, the extortion that they did. So wiretaps were a very important tool, but they were bloody boring to sit and listen
Not to. As exciting as it makes as they make it seem on TV.
Oh, no, it's horrible. You sit for like 8 hours just listening to these people. Sometimes that's if they get on the phone or if you've got a wire in the building. And then you just ad nauseum this just everyday crap.
Yeah, the day-to-day rumblings of your life. And you're like, that's not interesting, but maybe one piece will be.
Well, occasionally, it
pays off.
Exclamation of like some robbery they're going to do.
Yeah.
What they're going to have.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsors.
How did you get involved? And I'm trying to avoid spoilers in this group because, newsflash, we are going to be giving away this signed copy. So you see it, the signed copy of A Gun in My Gucci to one lucky listener today, or not today, for the next Get Vocal live stream. Elaine was kind enough to sign this for us. So it is an autographed copy, which is super sweet to have. But I don't want to give any spoilers away because I really want people to go and read this book because it is super interesting.
Thank you.
And it's truly enthralling. It was something that I couldn't put down. And I was like, I got to see what happens. Because the way you kick this book off is like a gut punch to your, you know, when you're reading to your imagination, you're like, how did this happen? And how it's kind of dumb luck, really.
Yes, it was dumb luck. And how it ended up was dumb
exactly.
luck. It was just like, so Hollywood, it was Hollywood. How
It is a story for a movie for sure. So how did you find yourself? I know this, but how did you find yourself going into the criminal division of looking into kind of this mob activity?
How did I find myself? Well, it was, I thought the key to being a good agent was not to sit in the office, but to get out on the street. And I forced myself to talk to one. My thing was, you have to talk to one person a day.
Oh, geez.
You have to meet. You got to knock on a door. You have to talk to one person a day. And it was like, oh, geez, I'm scared. Well, he's going to tell me to go away. How can I approach the guy that's head of the North Side or you know, La Cosa Nostra. Yeah. But I did, and I did time again. And that really paid off for me because I had approached Ken Edel on three different occasions attempting to flip it.
Yeah.
And so that was it. I just had, and I went out and I pounded on doors. I talked to people, and it worked. It yeah. worked because you never know. You never know when the shit's going to hit them that they're going to need to pick up the phone and maybe they'll talk to that woman.
Yeah.
That was an FBI agent that just came out of the blue and said, can I take you to coffee?
Yeah. That was insane. I was like, yeah, sure.
Oh, they all never drinks for sure. Most of them said, yeah, I said, can I take you to drink? Have a drink. Sure.
What can you tell us about Joe, Tokyo Joe, as he's known? How would you describe him and his role and involvement in the Chicago mob?
Well, he was truly a unique person. First of all, it was a while, months before I realized that he had almost a photographic memory. Mm-hmm. And so he and I could go back on a calendar like 3 years before and almost pinpoint times that he met with the bosses. Oh, wow. He remembered all of the details. He remembered how much he would put in an envelope to give them the cut. So what Joe was a professional gambler, and he would play poker. Now, these were high-stake poker games, and high-stake poker games are only sponsored by the mm-hmm. mob. I mean, you had to come in with a couple thousand dollars just to get into the game. And in the early years, they were guarded by, like, the soldiers in the mob, like the punks. And they would guard the game so there weren't any fights and everybody was going to get their pay. And, of course, they would get a cut, too, of the house's money. And these eventually turned out to be his bosses because he stayed gambling and running gambling operations himself with the mob. And he knew you couldn't run a gambling operation without paying the mob in Chicago, mm-hmm. period. Couldn't run prostitution. You couldn't run any kind of scam without paying the mob. They took their bite. And 35 years of it. And when he was shot and survived three shots to the head, he said, all bets are off.
Yeah.
I can't go back to them. I can't. They'll shoot me again. And I had talked to him so many, three times. He said, from his hospital bed, I want to talk to Special Agent Elaine Smith. And the commander that was there at his bed was astonished and said, who the F is Elaine Smith? I was nobody. I had 18 months. I was 18 months in the FBI, but I had gotten out there and I had talked to him.
And he made an impression.
And I had talked to other people. Yes.
I thought that was so interesting that, and the way that you lay out how he went basically to his death, or what was supposed to be his death, is definitely something
in movies.
Because you would be like, okay, I was thinking, like, how can I run from this? How would I get out of here? Like, how could I?
Oh, absolutely. Wait. I asked him many, many times, why did you do this? You knew you were going to get shot. Why'd you do this? He said, I had no other choice. I had no other life. I had to go meet them. And he really actually, he was a gambler. And he said, well, I figured out my odds. And he said, maybe my odds are that I'm not going to get shot and I can talk my way out of it. He was a very smooth talker. And he thought that, you know, he'd made a lot of money for these people and had never really
turned on them or anything.
Shinsed them on it. Yeah. But it wasn't happening.
Yeah. I mean, everybody is a risk once they become a risk, right? And so you just got to get rid of them. I mean, every mobster movie you've ever seen in your life, it's like the second somebody seems to be made, they're gone. So,
yeah, like the two guys that attempted to kill him in Bungalow.
Yeah.
We found them in the trunk. I mean, you know, with their underpants around their ankles and stab wounds and shooting shots. And it was horrible. They died a horrible
death. When I saw you go, I think the guys that shot Eto are in a trunk somewhere. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, of course we should expect this, right? Because if he's talking, then for sure he can make the men who tried to assassinate him, essentially.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I didn't approach these guys myself. Some of my squad mates did. They thought, you know, we sent the guys out, not me. And they wouldn't flip. One of them was pushed down the stairs by his wife. Yeah, it was kind of funny that they were, you know, how they lived on the second floor. And she was so pissed. And she just came and shoved him right down the stairs. Like,
get out of here, please. But
so I was kind of glad that I didn't go down there. You know, approach them. Yeah.
She's like, please leave my house. And by that, I mean, I'm going to shove you down the stairs. Why did she get in trouble for that?
No.
It was just kind of a part of the job.
I mean, it was, you know. That's crazy. Yeah, it was.
Because now I'm like, oh, you've assaulted a, you know, a public officer.
Yeah, that's a federal officer. Of course she had. She absolutely had.
That's insane to me.
Like I went, when we found the two guys in the trunk, I went to the one guy's house. His daughter was there. I came in and I said, I have, you know, some really terrible news to tell you. Maybe you'd like to sit down. And didn't say a word. They weren't talking to me at all. And they absolutely knew that he was dead. I wasn't telling them anything.
Because it kind of comes with
so life. Someone, yes, that, and I think someone had told them, called them.
And said, hey.
But I think it does. How can you accept that? How can you accept that your husband is eventually going to be knifed and shot?
Yeah,
and,
I mean, some brutal, violent death. I don't ever think it's ever an easy death. Like, even with Ken, three shots to the head is a lot.
Yeah.
You know? Kind of going back a little bit, what even made you interested in going through the organized crime side of, you know, the FBI, and what, you know, prompted you to go that route as opposed to, you know, the other routes that are available through the FBI?
I grew up in Chicago.
The mob.
It was like, you know, the mob. It was the mob. And every day, my parents would get the newspaper delivered to the front door, and I would read these headlines, another body found. And it sounds gruesome, but I was fascinated by it. It was,
you're in good company, you know, with that.
I just had to, oh, gosh, I got to find out about these people. And you know, all the mob movies, they glamorize it. I learned that it isn't glamorous unless you're really the top boss. There isn't a lot of money. You have to kick up everything. You have to scrounge for every piece of money you get. They're not living a fat life. They really aren't, except the high boss.
Which is another kind of myth that you really dispelled for me during that, is that I was like, why? I mean, they should have all this money and resources available. And it's like, they're like any other Joe Schmo out there working a 9-to-5.
Very Joe Schmo. With almost not even a high school education.
It's truly like they're taken off the street. So, and that's probably maybe the only part of the mob movies that is right, is that these kids are recruited off the street because they have nothing else to look forward to other than, hey, my uncle works for them too, so I'm going to join the family business essentially and work for them as well.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
It's insane. I don't want to get too involved into the story because it is really interesting and truly. You guys, if you are anxious like I am and don't like to wait for giveaways, you can head to thebookshop.org and search for A Gun in My Gucci. You get to support a independent bookseller and also buy Lane's book, which is really, really interesting. And if you are a fan of learning about the mob in general, and kind of the grandfathers of the mob, I would say the Chicago mob, you definitely want to read this book because it gives you such incredible insights into it. But you aren't just the person who helped take down the Chicago mob. You also have some other pretty awesome highlights to your career. So can you share those with us and your involvement with that, especially with what people are really fascinated by is the 9/11 involvement that you have. Yes. So can you share that with us?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that 9/11 was one of the most painful things that could have happened to us as FBI agents or people. And I, at that time, was supervising 26 other agents. And we were all in shock because we saw it on television just like everybody else did. And nobody had ordered us anywhere. And I just gathered all of us around. And I said, we're going to solve this. And we're going to work from now until we drop. Nobody goes on vacation. Nobody goes home tonight. We are going to work until we drop to solve this. And everybody was there. It was like all hands mm-hmm. on deck. And then I was called into the command center, and we started giving tasks to people to try to solve who did this. So at the time, I was categorized as an expert in financial matters, and my squad was too. And we were given one of the leads out of New York to develop the financial backgrounds of the 19 terrorists. We needed to know who sponsored this, who paid for this, and follow those leads into who was behind all of this. And so that is what we started doing. And we developed, they all had financial backgrounds here in the United States. We were able to develop those banking interests or credit cards that they had. One had a home mortgage, really. It was difficult to understand how this happened. But that I switched to 9/11, and I left my office for 5 months. And actually, no one did my work, and all the files were piled up high all around my office waiting for me to come back.
Hey, welcome to work.
Yeah. But when 9/11 happened, and afterwards, it was the entire FBI worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was absolutely the biggest push we'd ever had.
I can't even imagine. I mean, because it's truly an attack on, us in general as Americans. And so it was, I think in sixth grade when it happened, and I didn't understand it. I still to this day can't watch anything about it because it's so devastating to me about how great that loss was for us. And, we had experienced attacks before. We think about the Oklahoma City bombing, the previous bombings on the towers, but nothing with this type of gravity or
nothing prepared us for this.
Absolutely not. And so I think everybody who is, who was alive during that time and was able to witness it in real time, is taken back the second we start talking about 9/11. So, A, thank you very much for your service and helping determine that. And how you don't think about things like that, about how the financials, kind of help trace who financed everything, because you're just okay, who is responsible for this? But I wouldn't have thought to think, hey, we should start with the money, follow the money trail, So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I know. I worked drug cases with DEA, and they never wanted to have a woman, you can't go out on the buys, And I said, oh, I just took it off the top of my head. Well, I'll follow the money. And it was, sooner or later, they really, go ask Elaine, because she knows where all the money is. And so it was, allowed me a seat at the table.
Yeah.
I they didn't want to give me a seat at the table.
Yeah.
But I got to have a seat at the table. If I said, well, I'll empty the garbage cans, and then you find all the evidence in the garbage
can. That's what's so great about your story and how you present yourself is that you basically pull the chair out for yourself and say, hey, I'm going to sit here now. Hope you don't mind. But if you do, I'm still going to sit here. You did that with your entrance into the organized crime unit. I thought that was pretty great where you're like, hey, you want to go to breakfast? Then great. I'm going to transfer you over.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. I feel like you did that kind of in every step of your career. Like we talked about earlier, some of it was dumb luck. I know you had a friend who was leaving to go take care of her terminally ill father. And this kind of landed in your lap, too. And that kind of catapulted everything that happened in this book that was so truly making everything a page turner where you're like, okay, something's going to happen. And of course we get the tragedies that happen in this book, but also the triumphs that you go through in this book.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsors.
We learn, of course, of your experience and handling in the 9/11, but you also started teaching as a part, kind of going back to it and teaching curriculum for interview techniques, I believe. So was that kind of like an easy thing to get back into where you're like, okay, get back into teaching kind of?
No. It was I was part of the study where we developed how you interview agents. You know, everybody sat around the United States and figured out what are the characteristics we want in an agent. And we came up with like 8 characteristics. And then we did, you know, now we have hired professionals, PhDs from the University of Minnesota and whatnot to, and what questions do you ask these people in order to see if they have these qualities, in order to see if that they'll not give up, they'll hardworking, they won't look at their watch at 5 o'clock and I got to go home. How do you elicit that behavior from them? And so I was part of developing those questions and the new interview process. And then the Bureau at that time was really under, you know, some, they were going to get their butts sued because they had shown prejudice against women and minorities in interviewing them. And so we had to make something that was really couldn't influence by your opinion as one of the interviewers, that, you know, had to be more
equitable.
Fair. That's amazing. Yeah. Equitable. Right.
See, look at you, trailblazer everywhere. I love it. One question I had to, and it just escaped my brain, but what do you want people to get from your book? What lesson or what are you hoping when somebody finishes this book, the feeling that they get or the lesson that they take from it, what are you wanting people to learn? If anything, that you're a badass?
I think it was just, well, no. I think it was, my grandchildren would never think I was a badass, okay? So I think it was just to tell a great story and just to tell a story of somebody, if you work hard, if you try, you can do it. You can do it. You don't have to be 6 foot and 200 pounds. Man, you know, you can weigh 110 pounds and you can really be a force. And you can really put people in jail and put them people in jail for a long time. And so there are opportunities for everyone, no matter who you are.
We recently covered a case. I thought this was interesting because I've really been interested in espionage cases here lately. We recently covered a case on the show, kind of on the CIA side with Harold Nicholson. What do you think about things like that? I was really confused as to how somebody can go through all the trouble of like joining the CIA, joining the FBI, and then essentially becoming a turncoat, if you will. So what do you think about people who go through all that trouble? Like, think about what you went through to join and the academy to have somebody kind of just throw it all away. Harold Nicholson was one of the, you know, top guys at the CIA or in a really high position and basically sold secret agent information over to the Russians back in, I think, the early 90s and so. So What do you have to say about that? And you can be candid.
Oh, well, there's Robert Hansen, who was an FBI agent.
He's the one I'm going to cover next.
Yeah. And he, you know, what do I think of them? I think they're idiots. They're broken. And, despicable.
Is there a lot of opportunity to become what do they call those when they,
a double agent? You know, I worked organized crime, and so organized crime was not going to approach
you. Like, we don't want you.
But I think that, they're going to do, I think they're the Soviets, the Chinese, whomever, are always on the lookout for somebody that they can approach. And it's going to be somebody that they sense has a weakness. Someone that is having an affair. Someone that is drinking. Someone that's drinking too much. Someone who's doing drugs. That they always look for someone that has a weakness. And then they'll work on that weakness and get them to be compromised. Yeah, that's what they're doing.
Insane and very true. I will open the floor up to questions while I give the giveaway information before we wrap up with Elaine. So if anybody has any questions, go ahead submit those in the chat box there and we'll ask. But in order to enter into the giveaway for Elaine's book called A Gun in My Gucci, you will need to send me an email to tcfcpod@gmail.com with the subject EC Gucci to make sure you're listening and that you hear that. So subject EC Gucci and your mailing address, and I will draw the winner at the next Get Vocal live stream, which is going to be next Thursday, 7 p.m. Central Time. Elaine, I don't know if you have a huge social media presence or not, but feel free to share where we can find you, where you'd like us to go if we want to get more information.
Yes, I have a website. It's A Gun in My Gucci.
Is that Mr. Smith?
Yeah, that's Tommy. Yeah. The love of my life, my high school sweetheart.
Yes, who became, you want to talk about the incident?
Yeah, and recruited me.
Incident about how his life was almost gone. Just real quickly. Yeah. If you want to...
At 36, he was shot in the abdomen in a training accident. And he developed peritonitis, which is an inflammation or infection bacteria in the peritoneal lining of your abdomen. And it almost killed him. And it was very lucky. We had a very brilliant surgeon at the University of Chicago who operated on him 3 times. And everybody pitched in. He had to have blood. And the blood would come in. It was donated by people. And I would say to him, oh, that's Roger Nielsen's blood that you're getting. Because everybody donated blood because he needed blood. And it was a terrible experience. But it also showed love that people
It's incredible.
Had for him,
and he, the way that you represent him, your relationship in the story, and the way that he supports you, I love that he joined you kind of going out on this first call. And I was just talking to Tom and you were like, I don't know if he knew that you're just my husband. You're just kind of my hired arm now. And I'm the one asking the questions here. So I thought that was really interesting. And I'm glad that, you know, you had that support, which I think is really important for people, you know, who are trying to pursue something that they're passionate about, is that all they really need is themselves and maybe one other person who just believes in them and is willing to help them and encourage them, you know, go past that finish line to reach their goals. And
particularly, I think maybe if you're a woman. And
yeah,
you have
children, I love your daughter saying, I didn't even think about it. I was just going to eat cereal.
It's not easy.
Yeah. So how was that for you as a mother to be gone from her for 6 months? Because you had a young daughter.
Oh, it was tough. It was very tough. I came home on weekends a few times and I would just spontaneously start crying like I'm unloading the dishwasher and I just start crying because I missed them. I missed being there with my child, my husband. And I missed being soft and warm. And I realized when I got on the plane to go back to Quantico, D.C., I changed. It was like a cloak came over me and I became something different. I was no longer mommy. I was no longer my wife. I was, you know, this robot from the FBI that was going back.
It was truly a great read. I got a lot from it. And kind of like what Mel here said was that she needed to hear that in regards to chasing your dreams truly and going after what you want. It is not only is it a really interesting story about how you kind of ingrain yourself with Ken or Tokyo Joe, you also find a way to make things happen for yourself when the odds are truly stacked against you, because you're in a time where, you know, we're talking about like glass ceilings and it was like right at the top of your head. It wasn't something far away. It was something you truly had to break on your own. And it's a really inspiring story that I think not only do you get a really interesting story about the Chicago mob, which, you know, takes your true crime fix to the next level, but you also learn something from it. And it inspired me where I was like, I saw parts of myself and the ambition that I have in your story. And I hope that other people get that from you as well. And when they read your book, because it was transformative for me to kind of have that affirmation that, hey, it's possible, you know, and you had gone through this career that you'd been in for so long and take a leap into something else that was completely unknown, that they could have said, you know what, you're not good enough, go home. And, you know, you had to go back and on your knees and beg for your job again as a school teacher, but you didn't.
Yes, that would have been horrible. God, I can't even imagine that. They wouldn't let me back in the English department.
But I think that's so amazing. And so it was really inspiring that anybody who's truly looking to make changes in their lives can look at this story and see how much. Yeah, it was so successful for you. And you hit bumps and you hit, you know, stop signs along the way, really. And you still managed to get out on top. You got your guy, as they like to say, and you have a fantastic career and an incredible legacy that I think this book is basically marked for you. It's your legacy, and it's amazing.
Thank you. You're embarrassing me now.
Thank you.
Yeah, you did very well.
So we didn't get any questions in here, but I think that's because you did such a great job. And I truly didn't want to spoil anything, you guys, so I'm so sorry. We could have gotten into some really good stuff, but...
We can follow up.
If you do have any questions for real, let me know. Yeah. We can get Elaine back on. It would be great to have you and Jerry Williams on at the same time. She also, So Jerry has her own podcast as well. And you should think about joining us in the podcast world, because what a story you have to tell. And this could be multiple episodes. So
thank you,
everybody. No problem. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube, and on Get Vocal. For a conversation with Elaine about her book. Again, if you want to get some TCFC goodies and also a chance to win Elaine's book, you have to subscribe to the channel and make sure you send me an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com, with EC Gucci in the subject line and your home address or wherever you want your stuff mailed to. Elaine, thank you again so much.
Wonderful. Elaine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. So that was our conversation with Elaine Smith, A Gun in My Gucci. Remember that you just need to subscribe to us on Get Vocal. Send me a screenshot of that with the title EC Gucci in the subject line, and you will be entered to win your signed copy of this book. So I really appreciate everybody joining us. What a fascinating conversation. So make sure that you guys, if you have any questions for Elaine, if you can't wait to read the book, be for sure to send those to me and I'll pass them along, or we'll have Elaine back on if she's interested. So thanks again, you guys. I hope you have a great evening. I'm going to go ahead and stop the broadcast.
Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and positively review the show on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter @TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast. We're also on Instagram @TrueCrimeFanClubPod. If you have an episode request, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. This episode was researched and written by Susie St. John. Content editing by Brittany Martinez. Produced by the best in the business, Nico @WeTalkOfDreams. Check him out on Twitter @WeTalkOfDreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com.